Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom in an effort to help people better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster peace. I'm your host, Kerr Hallenbeck. Genesis Farm was founded in 1980 by the Dominican Sisters of Caldwell, New Jersey, in response to increasing awareness of ecological and environmental challenges that we face. This 200-plus acre farm is rooted in a belief that the universe, earth, and all reality are permeated by the presence and power of that ultimate holy mystery that has been so deeply and richly expressed in the world's spiritual traditions. This sacred mystery, known by so many religious names, is the common thread in their efforts. Miriam McGillis is director and co-founder of Genesis Farm. In 2007, Grist magazine named her one of the world's top 15 green religious leaders, and she joins us today. Miriam, welcome to the program, and thank you so much for being with us today.
You're very welcome, Kerr, and thank you. You have a wonderful mission statement.
Oh, thank you, and also with you. Now, first, could you tell us about some of the events that led to the founding of Genesis Farm? And you can please take your time. You have the floor.
Well, thank you. I think the events that were really working were larger than just the smaller events of the Dominican Sisters being bequeathed a 140-acre farm out in the northwestern part of New Jersey. This period was a time of so much transition and change, not only in the country, but in the Catholic Church and in the Dominican Order, of which I am a member, but all set against the background of the post-World War II era. And so during the 60s and 70s, we know that the nation was in a huge challenging situation with the era of the Vietnam Wars, civil rights, feminism. In the Catholic Church, it was the period of the Vatican Council, Vatican II, is often called, and sisters generally all over the country, all over the world, were deeply sensitive to all of these larger factors. And I think you can't understand Genesis Farm unless you understand that was the history out of which it emerged. So it was left to my Dominican congregation, in somebody's will in 1978. And it was the estate of a Rupert von Becklin, and we never knew him. So the gift of the farm was itself, I think, rather mysterious and just a couple of coincidences by which we were named to inherit it. And it was the time, 1978, 79, this period, too, was a time of awareness of some of the global realities that had emerged on the world scene and which were being felt in a lot of peace organizations and social justice organizations. And I, at the time, was working with a group called Global Education Associates, and we were working very much out of the philosophy and the promises that were implicit in the United Nations and in the ability of that forum, if it were entered into, you know, with authenticity, could bring us out of the militarism and the national security obsession which had us locked up in the Cold War era. And my work was in that arena, and in the late 70s, we were very aware of the world food crisis and the emerging World Conference on Food that was held in Rome, and the creating of new global institutions based on democratic values, which would address the issue of hunger from a global perspective. And so that is the world I was coming out of when we were given Genesis Farm.
Now,
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
I think the second major thing with that is that the year prior, 1977, while I was working with that organization called Global Education Associates, that was the first time I and we, the organization, ever heard the insights and writings of Thomas Berry, who happened to be a Passionist priest, a geologian, and was living and working in Riverdale, New York, at the Riverdale Center for Religious Studies. And the presentation he gave was mind-changing and world-changing for us and for me in particular. So this idea of needing a different story, a cosmological story, became very central as an event leading to the creating of Genesis Farm.
Thank you so much for that backdrop. Yes, I've been influenced by the work of Thomas Berry as well, and we can explore a little of that later. But I wanted to ask you a couple of questions based on the things you just shared, and for our listeners as well. For example, when we talk about Vatican II and the changes that was ushering in, can you just share a little bit, when you talk about changes in the church, what was the mood of Vatican II that was part of this backdrop?
I think the larger issues behind it were would be colored by the realization that Europe had come out of two devastating wars. We call them world wars. And on all sides of national boundaries were Christians fighting each other. And there was something traumatic in the realization of that, I believe, for the Christian church, and in my case, the Catholic church. Something was obviously wrong. And there was also the realization of the growth globally of the church and the experience of people on the ground in countries all over the world, especially in non-industrialized countries who were suffering so deeply from the ravages of colonialism and the rapid expansion of the Western world into those regions and the growth of the economic industrial model. So that was certainly playing out, but one has to see something miraculous in the papacy of Pope John 23rd, who came into the church after the death of Pius XII, as believed to be an interim pope, and he had such a sense of the world, of the pain of the world, and he had the courage to say, "We have to re-examine who we are as the body of the church. Something's wrong with how we are, and we need to be in touch with the world and not outside the world, not a power unto ourselves." So he basically opened up the world to the church and said, "You know, we're not here for ourselves. The gift of faith is given to be at the service of the common good." And when he wrote that encyclical, Pacem in Terris, and it was a letter to the world, he took the most pioneering and courageous, big-hearted gesture that probably anyone had ever experienced from the Roman Church.
And you know, it's interesting, Sister, people tend to use the phrase about Vatican II, sort of like throwing open the windows and letting the air in. Now, you also mentioned some events that happened in 78, 79. I'm wondering if you're referring to anything of an ecological status then, because we've had some disasters in terms of Chernobyl, in terms of Three Mile Island, in terms of other things like that. Were those some of the events that you were referring to?
Well, they would certainly be among a whole litany of events, but I think one of the key things was, if you go back to, it was Rachel Carson's publication Silent Spring, which sent shockwaves around the world in terms of the unintended consequences of the synthetic chemicals that had been invented since World War II and had been just drenching the air and the soil and the water through the industrial economic model that we were committed to as a U.S. and certainly as the industrialized nations of the world. And so that set off the first Earth Day, as well as a whole realm of policies and programs that the United States took on. But it also was very instrumental in setting up the stage for the United Nations' first conference on the environment, which I believe was in Stockholm in 1972, where the world leaders came together and said, look, we can't solve these problems alone. The air doesn't stop at our national boundaries or the waters or rivers or fish. Mm. So that was another major watershed of global thinking about the planet as a whole. And then we can't forget the stunning experience of seeing the Earth from space, which was what our astronauts gave us. No humans before us have ever seen this planet from outside of it. And the realization it was alive, it was doing the work, doing the activities of a living organism. This was stunning. We never imagined this. And so I think those things had major influences on a lot of the other things that followed.
Yes, I was about 6 years old, I think, when we landed on the moon and that picture went out. That was so humbling.
Yeah.
And I didn't really understand even entirely what I was looking at. But it made such a deep impression that one of my first little 45 records, when they made 45s, was of the conversation between the astronauts in Houston that was published with the landing. And I listened to it over and over again as a little kid. It was very, very impactful. Now let's talk about Genesis Farm. What is the work of Genesis Farm, and what kind of programs do you offer?
Well, they have certainly shifted and changed and adapted to the historic realities of the times over our 32 years. We'll be 33 years in May and since we were founded. And its focus has been helping to articulate as best we could and to say very humbly that most of the time we didn't know what we were doing. We were trying to learn and understand the implications of what we might call the universe story, the evolution of the universe, the Earth story, as Thomas Perry and Brian Swim had tried so hard to help us all understand in the 80s. So we were studying, internalizing, grappling with that, and trying out of those understandings to consider how we might understand the present social, economic, political systems, religious systems, medical systems, as not being quite in alignment with the understandings of a living planet and a universe which has had a spiritual dimension to it from the very beginning. And then the ecological challenges of, well, what does it mean for humans grasping this or trying to understand it? What does it mean to change the way we inhabit the planet as one species among all of the species in a particular place, or what we might call our bioregion, so that we are not a problem to the Earth, but rather are the Earth in the form of a human trying to be consciously understanding, thinking, caring, choosing, acting as though we were one member of a great community of being.
And you mentioned Thomas Berry. And by the way, listeners, The Universe Story is an amazing book if you haven't read it. It just sort of tells or retells the story of creation that in a way that incorporates what we know scientifically and otherwise, and it's beautiful. I mean, the way the elements come into the universe through through supernovae is like hearing the nine choirs of angels being called. It's a beautiful book, highly recommended. I have a little quote here from Thomas Berry. He says, "Without the soaring birds, without the great forests, the free-flowing streams, the sight of the clouds by day, and the stars by night, we become impoverished in all that makes us human." And that's a little example of Thomas Berry. So now then, so today, in terms of your response to this increasing awareness and sort of unifying of what we know as the material world with a spiritual energy, what can someone expect who might want to go to your farm for a workshop or a program?
Well, actually, your question about what they would expect this year, we'd have to suspend a little bit because since last March, we have really made a decision to take an indefinite amount of time to discern what is the next phase of the forms that Genesis Farm might offer to bring about a deeper understanding of these amazing mysteries within the universe and the earth, natural world, within the simple cell, and how that relates to everything about our human existence, our identity, our health, our souls, our meanings. So we have been in a year of suspension of programs. And apart from one that we gave on the transition movement in September, and then our really anchor program, which is a 2-week residential course in the Epic of Evolution, the Universe Story, we have suspended all of our other programs in order to be able to think and study and reflect and continue to be in dialogue with others, discern what is the next phase of our life here? What is the next phase? Because 32 years later, there are any number of films, and I would also emphasize or highlight three incredible new resources which didn't exist until very, very recently. And the one is the DVD film called The Journey of the Universe, which was created by Brian Swim and Mary Evelyn Tucker and John Grimm.
Right.
And a book of the same title. And then a series of educational interviews that go with the film. And so that was available in 2010. It was 2011. I forget now. Time goes so fast. But so much, there are so many more resources that are available by way of films and documentaries, and both in the theory of the universe story, but also in the application in terms of sustainable agriculture, renewable energy, you know, why GMOs are bad for us to be playing around with, whatever,
yeah.
You know. So we sort of suspended our hands-on workshops on how to grow food or how to, because so many other people were doing it, and we didn't have to continue to do that. Rather, we want to support the ones who are doing it and go deeper into the dynamics of the universe to draw from them the principles and the guidance that we might be able to integrate. And one great interest is how do we integrate them with our religious perspectives? Because all the world's religions, as well as indigenous spirituality, they all carry these patterns of how the universe actually works, and the beauty of their diversity is essential to hold on to. But all of that insight, which was created by ancestors living at a different time, those insights need to be opened up to the ecological aspect they hold within them, but which have not yet emerged. So that's what we've been pondering.
Well, you know, taking time to reflect is such an essential thing that so many of us have, you know, trouble with. We really do need to reflect a whole lot more, and that is an incredibly productive time. Can you tell us a little bit about the Dominican Sisters, and how does this work or ministry sit within the history or mission of the Sisters?
Actually, the Dominican Sisters were founded by St. Dominic back when he founded his order. He started a little monastery of sisters to pray for the purpose and the mission of this order that he was creating. And he was a pretty radical innovator for his time, because back in his time, if you went into a religious order, you were usually monastic and you were enclosed and you never left. It was based on the Benedictine model of monastic stability. And he had a great burning desire to be engaged in kind of the crossroads of Europe with ideas. He wanted to grapple with ideas, and so he founded his order to be a mendicant. It's called mendicant, out on the road, engaged in towns and villages, and especially university towns, to be able to engage with ideas wherever they were coming from. And the sisters remained enclosed for most of that, of the history from the 1200s till late 1800s. And my actual branch of Dominican sisters comes from, a convent in Ratisbon, or Regensburg, it's sometimes called, in Germany. And that monastery had been founded by a very famous Dominican teacher called Albert the Great, and his student was Thomas Aquinas. But he founded that convent, and it's never been closed. It's been in existence ever since. But in the 1800s, when many German immigrants were coming to the United States, there was a need for sisters to come and help keep the language, the culture, and their religious beliefs alive. And so a bishop from the Midwest came to Germany and asked, would that convent spare a couple of sisters to send to the United States and to accompany the German immigrants as they were moving across the continent? So that's how our community was founded, the branch I'm from. And we just celebrated our 130th.
Now, St. Dominic, I think, along with people like St. Ignatius of Loyola, were also very influenced by Francis of Assisi, I believe. And, of course, Francis, known for his relationship with nature and the environment and the praising of all things and the solidarity of all things, including men and women, not only the humans in relation to the earth. Does that, any of that kind of spirituality trickle down into the Dominican sisters as well in some form of spiritual awareness or practice?
Well, actually, Francis and Dominic were contemporaries, and Francis was also a pretty radical innovator.
Yes, indeed.
Moved from the monastic to being out in the world, and they were friends. And they were trying to get approval for their orders at the same time. So they knew each other. And there's been a kind of fondness between them that has remained throughout the hundreds of years that both of the orders have been in existence. So I think that there's always been a deep appreciation of the Franciscan heritage. And just like most humans relate to Francis, because he's such a beautiful figure of humility and his capacity to feel a communion with birds and wolves and poor people. And so I think he's always been a source of great inspiration. But I think in terms of where a lot of religious sisters are today, they have probably, in addition to that tradition inside the Franciscan order, I think they've been hugely moved by their study of Thomas Berry's work, Teilhard de Chardin's work. Teilhard was a Jesuit who was born in 1881, died in 1955, and was both a Jesuit and a paleontologist, a scientist, and who had this huge instinct that matter had spirit. Matter and spirit were the same, and who had this sense that the universe was a spiritual evolving process, and that the human was implicated in it from the beginning. That, I think, has had a huge impression on sisters. It certainly did on me. And so I'd say that's the stronger
influence.
influence, yes.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating one, and we're going to explore a little more of that in the second part of the show. We're about halfway through the program already, Miriam, and I'm just going to take a short break. Would you please just stay on the line, and we'll be right back. You are listening to the Godspeed Institute, a program dedicated to religious tolerance and spiritually based living. When we return from the break, we'll continue our conversation on Genesis Farm with Sister Miriam McGillis. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. You are live with CARE, and we're speaking with Sister Miriam McGillis, director and co-founder of Genesis Farm. Miriam, we were just speaking about certain spiritual thought leaders like Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, and also Teilhard de Chardin, who helped to bring together, as you said, the realization that all matter is spiritual. We tend to think in terms of categories scientifically as we explore things, like there's matter and there's energy, and there's dark matter and there's dark energy, etc. And you were just raising the topic of conversation that, in fact, matter and spirit have always been connected and one from the beginning, and that the human being has been placed in there from the beginning as well. Can you please share a little bit more about this this line of thought and where it is today? How is it affecting your awareness today?
It's hard for me to speak about where it is outside. You know, I mean, it, with the world, but it's certainly there is such an expression of so many individuals and groups all over who are speaking about evolutionary consciousness and new consciousness, and it's amazing how that has exploded in the last 15 to 20 years, and especially in the last five. And of course, with the internet, it's just so accessible to many, many people. In terms of my own consciousness or the work of Genesis Farm, it has been central, and it affects everything. It's so humbling because once you, I guess, really step over a threshold into this new dimension of understanding, you realize how little we will ever know or grasp to the degree that it is possible, because we're stepping into an infinite.
Yes, it's amazing. It does seem like we really, even at our best, only get a glimpse. Into this, and science tells us our eyes can only perceive like 10% of what we're looking at. So, yeah. You know, that's probably about right. It's interesting that you mentioned that interest in this field or awareness has peaked, let's say, in perhaps in the Western culture in the past 5 years, because the past 5 years have been seriously difficult. Mm-hmm. It almost seems as though the pendulum of materialism has swung to the furthest extent on one side some years back, and, you know, we've been kind of reeling from it. So it's kind of interesting that along at the same time comes perhaps the seeking of a different way of looking at things. You know, rather than, for another word, greed, you know.
Yeah, and there's just nothing satisfying in the model of growth, economic growth, and the commercialization and privatization of everything. There is no peace, there's no joy, there's no satisfaction. It's such a distortion. It's an illness, I think, and it's so deep in the collective psyche right now for many of us. And then we're all kind of implicated in small ways or larger ways because we live inside those systems. We can't extricate ourselves from them, even if we want to, because of the nature of life today and the speed of it. And so I don't know if we even have words for the danger, the dangerous waters we're navigating.
Yeah, and it's almost something you can feel, like it's palpable, you know, the suffering in the country and in the world that's gone around like a ripple effect.
Yep.
I think we are just kind of reeling. But you mentioned growth just now, and I just wanted to, as far as environmental growth and response to our environment ecologically, I'd like to just focus on growth for a moment, because one of my favorite descriptions is the definition of sin by Gregory of Nyssa, who is a 4th century theologian. He said simply that sin is refusal to grow. Mm-hmm. How does that relate to our relationship, to your mind, as human beings in relation to our environment and the earth?
Well, I think he was talking about an internal spiritual growth, that it's a refusal to grow up. It's a refusal to evolve into the depth of possibility that is given us by existence itself. And if you are a person of faith, you say God, it's the God nature, it's the Christ nature, the Buddha nature, whatever. But that does not ever arrive at total wisdom or perfection.
I guess what I mean by that is I feel we're being called upon to grow as human beings and respond to this, that, you know, when we're told about global warming, when we're told about pollution, when we're talked about all these things we keep doing and that we perhaps keep ignoring, that there's something we're not responding to, and there's a refusal. It's taking a very long time. As you said, we were having these conversations back in the 70s.
Yes.
And before, I'm sure.
Yeah, and that growth, I think what you're talking about is like changing our consciousness and changing our behavior, changing our patterns of dependency and addiction and just dependency on a material purpose for our lives, which is, you know, can run anywhere from 1 to 100 on a scale of degree.
Right.
So I think our refusal to grow inwardly is a refusal to let go of old patterns of behavior and dependency, especially in our addiction to material goods and energy and all the physical or commercial ways we're told we're going to find happiness. And I think that leaves such a deep hunger in the spirit, in the soul, in the psyche, because none of that can ever satisfy us. So what we do is we just keep consuming, and manufacturing more and better and bigger, and that is totally detrimental to the earth community, to the whole, all the natural world. Every system is under the stress of that already, beyond saving. We don't know.
Sister, you say that the sacred mystery known by so many religious names is the thread throughout your work. Could you please share with us some of the viewpoints of the sacred mystery from the Catholic and also from different traditions you may be aware of?
the Holy One or the Old One or the Ancient One or the God or the Divine or whatever names people have used to speak of that ineffable mystery that cannot be defined or can't be defined or controlled. That I think that is the heart of all religious traditions, all cultural and religious traditions. And so, but it remains mysterious. In most of the classical religions, it remains mysterious, or it is not assigned to an image or a category or a definition, as in Buddhism. And then in indigenous traditions, it's sometimes named or imaged or, but it eludes all image. And I think the way we would try to honor all of that is that in looking at the universe itself, if the universe, if a religious tradition says the universe was made by this Holy One, this mysterious one, this sacred mystery, then the universe itself is a revelation, an unveiling of aspects of that mystery. So to study and contemplate that process of the universe and the creation of Earth and the process of Earth's developing is to look into that infinite mystery. And one of the things that becomes very, very clear is that it is highly differentiated. The diversity is extraordinary on every level of this universe story process. And so the value of diversity must be central to the one out of which, or the mystery out of which the universe comes. It has to be, because it's a revelation of it. I think that the religions of the world in their historic development have been trying to establish a sacred relationship of the individual or the community with this divine being or mystery for their whole story. And in many instances, the way humans did that was through a transcendent relationship with that divine being of a spiritual nature, which usually had implications for one's moral behavior. Hmm. And increasingly over the last centuries, I think it has taken on the social dimension of love of the neighbor and compassion for all humans and respect for all humans. And I believe where it's leading us now is that if the Earth is the living being from which humans are derived and upon which we are dependent, then the neighbor, the idea of the neighbor, the community, commons, has to extend to the whole of Earth and universe, because it's all one. It's a single unity.
Thank you so much for that answer. Sister Miriam, do you have any anecdotes to share from the, you say you just had an, it's been like 30 years that the Genesis Farm has been since you were founded. Are there any like memories or standout stories that come to your mind about where you felt, you know, yes, we're doing it, this is it, and I'm seeing it in front of me? Could you share some of the stories of Genesis Farm?
I suspect that all of the stories of all of the people who have come here and have left with their understanding of the universe story and then move out into the world, move out to different places, different countries, different cultures, and are trying, just like we're trying, to find ways and words and images and examples of how to communicate this and then bring their own lives and their community lives into alignment with what Earth is doing in those places. You know, when I say that, what the natural world needs, I think that that's a powerful image. The sense that our whole species, something is stirring in us that's coming from a source deeper than us, is an image that inspires and encourages and supports the hard work of the day-to-day being faithful to all that it takes to create a space like Genesis Farm and administer it and care for it and welcome people to it. It's a very demanding ministry. It's so at the service of something greater than ourselves. And I guess it's always the thought of the children of the future, as Thomas Berry would say, all the children, the fish children, the bird children, all of them waiting in the future for us to do what we can do in order to make their lives possible. These kinds of thoughts and images are what are central to our sense of faithfulness and purpose.
Now, I remember the first time I ever went on a weekend retreat, and there was a silent dinner meal, and I was overcome with this unfortunate fit of giggles. And by the end of that weekend, I was so at peace with the silence and found the difficulty came when I left and had to sort of wanted to maintain that centeredness from the experience, and at the same time having to enter back into the world, you know, of the cell phones and the cars and all of that. What can you advise folks who are environmentally inclined, as we are, in terms of simple things when they, whether they go to a program or a workshop or whatnot, and they want to keep carrying that? What are some simple things that they can do to sort of maintain that center and not be swept away again?
It's not easy in these times for anybody. Certainly isn't easy for me. But I've discovered without hesitation that if I don't get up early in the morning, in the dark, and have those initial hours or whatever to feed my mind and soul, then I can't. I just can't do it.
So that daily practice.
And then the other, and I am so blessed that I just walk out of my door and I am in the most beautiful natural setting. So the need to, in any way we can, recover our physical, emotional experience of the natural world, whether it's the night sky on a city balcony or rooftop, or bringing pots of plants into our one-room apartment, we have to be touched and blessed, I think, by the natural world. It's just so critical to who we are.
Thank you so much, Miriam. And I've got a quote here, another one from Teilhard. He says, "Someday, after mastering the winds, the waves, the tides, and gravity, we shall harness for God the energies of love, and then for a second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire."
Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, sure. And thank you for being on the program today. As we come to the end of our interview, I just want to let listeners know that your website and contact information will be posted on our homepage shortly at GodspeedInstitute.com, as well as some of the books and thought leaders you have mentioned in the program. It's been a distinct pleasure speaking with you, Sister Miriam, and learning about the Genesis Farm and such critically important work in this in our arena today.
Well, thank you for asking me, and I think the work you're doing is just as critically important, so thank you for that too, Care.
Oh, you're welcome, and all blessings in the new year.
Yes, same to you.
Miriam McGillis of Genesis Farm. To learn more, visit genesisfarm.org. Over the years, I've learned so much through the conversations with our guests, including Sister Miriam. Admittedly, when I asked her about the programs held at the farm and she replied that they're currently suspended for a time of reflection, my eyes opened wide and I thought, oh no, there goes the next 8 minutes of discussion. What'll I do? Such is the mindset of radio. It's also the mindset for most of the Western world, I imagine, including this theologically trained spiritual author and counselor. The concept of downtime is becoming obsolete. Stopping for reflection is akin to doing nothing in our culture. In fact, many would consider it unproductive, in quotes, as we have come to define ourselves in terms of productivity. Thomas Berry, Genesis Farm, and I ask the question, but what does that mean to our humanity? How does that affect the very experience of being human? This week, CNN published an article online about the importance of a stop day, based on a new book by Dr. Matthew Sleeth called 24-6, A Prescription for a Healthier, Happier Life. Dr. Sleeth explains that for almost 2,000 years, Western culture stopped, primarily on Sunday, for about 24 hours. He notes that even when he was a child, you couldn't buy gasoline, you couldn't buy milk, the drugstores weren't open, the only thing that was open was a hospital. And so society had just one day where they put it in park, and that was Sunday till the last 30 years or so. Dr. Sleeth continues to explain that we go 24/7 now in our culture and that he thinks it's having health consequences. He suggests this schedule leads to depression and anxiety. He notes that when a doctor sits down and does a primary intake with a new patient, they ask about smoking, exercise, and diet, but they don't ask how much you're working. They don't get any sense of whether you're working 7 days a week, or if you even have set any time aside, like people have always had, for rest. Dr. Sleeth recommends that we as a culture reinstate a stop day, one day, to really cease from our labors. He acknowledges that in Western culture, this comes from the Ten Commandments, and in his book, he looks at how labor has changed over the millennia. In 24-6, he doesn't try to define what rest is for a person, but asks readers to figure out what work is for you, and that we find a way to not do it one day out of the week. Dr. Sleeth finds that there's a growing epidemic of depression, and that the U.S. is the most depressed country in the world. The World Health Organization says somewhere between 1 in 9 and 1 in 10 Americans is being treated for depression. We tend to work more hours than any other country in the world, with Japan coming in a close second. When we're constantly going, we pour out chemicals to try to meet those stresses. We have short-term stress hormones like adrenaline and longer-term hormones like the steroids we produce. But the state of these chemicals constantly being on is not good for us. It leads to anxiety and depression, and perhaps plays a part in diabetes and obesity as well. Dr. Sleeth says that his family adopted, or rather readopted, this practice about 10 years ago. His children were teenagers. They went through high school and college keeping one day of rest where they didn't study. They got their work done ahead of time. And he suggests that it actually helps you to order your life. How does that sound in these chaotic times? Because in preparing for the day of rest, you actually get more things done in the 6 days you're working. In his family, they took this very seriously, and the kids actually became the guardians of the day of rest when they lived at home. They wanted to see it happen, and Dr. Sleeth feels it actually helped them as a family. He shares that others he knows who have reclaimed the day of rest find it has been the single best thing they've done for their marriage, their family, and their spiritual relationship. Another health-related issue our culture faces that is related is lack of sleep, or as Macbeth describes, the innocent sleep, sleep that knits up the raveled sleeve of care, sore labor's bath, balm of hurt minds, great nature's second course, chief nourisher in life's feast. Rest is one of the great benefits of spiritual life. Retreats and monastic communities invite us to rest, to find sanctuary, to feel the healing effects of restoring one's mind and reconnecting to who we are inside, not just what we do. Imagine the kind of strategic plans that might come out of companies who allow rest, who expect 24-6 from employees, who nurture the part of us that needs the well to be refilled. The act of stopping and reflecting, perhaps so foreign to us at this time, is a necessary ingredient to growth, healthy growth of mind, body, and spirit. And that's this week's tip for your spiritual tool belt that you wrap around yourself each day. Thank you for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. I'm your host, Care Hallenbeck, and the program was produced by Michael Hallenbeck. The Godspeed Institute is an independent educational organization dedicated to promoting religious tolerance and celebrating the value of spiritually based living. If you'd like to hear this or any of our previous programs again, or send it to someone, simply go to GodspeedInstitute.com. Please send your comments to office@GodspeedInstitute.com. We always enjoy hearing from you. And join us again as we continue to explore all the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Until then, we wish you Godspeed on your journey.